From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Boosting creativity is not a magical process, says journalist Jonah Lehrer. In his newest book, Imagine How Creativity Works, Lehrer explores different thought processes that anyone can use to foster creativity, and he provides numerous examples to show how it works. He also debunks the myth that creativity is a gift possessed only by a few. And he'll join us in studio for the hour. You're invited as well after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Jonah Lehrer's newest book is all about how neurology and creativity interact. A former Rhodes Scholar and contributing editor at Wired and frequent contributor to The New Yorker, he writes the Head Case column for The Wall Street Journal and regularly appears on WNYC's Radio Lab. His writing has appeared in Nature, The New York Times Magazine, Scientific America, and Outside, and he is the author of the best-selling Proust Was a Neuroscientist, which he discussed with us on Forum, and a book called How We Decide, and his newest book is called Imagine How Creativity Works. Joins us in studio this Forum Hour. Good to see you. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, let's talk about creativity, because a lot of people are under the misimpression, you would say, that there is such a thing as a creative type and maybe even a creative genius. You're dissuading us of that?
You know, I think the problem with the myth of the creative type is it leads the rest of us to assume that we are just not creative at all, that creativity is this all-or-nothing phenomenon, and you either have it, in which case you've somehow got access to the muses. And if you don't, you're just like the rest of us, and you're confined to repeating the work of others for the rest of your life. And you see this mirrored in these sad surveys of school kids. So every second grader is convinced that they're creative. 95% of second graders say, yep, I'm creative. I love to draw. I love to paint. I love to sketch. By fifth grade, that number's down to about 50%. By the time they're seniors in high school, that number is between 5 and 10%. So we have come to really believe, and you see this reflected in the school kid surveys, that creativity is this very, very rare gift. And you have to be a creative type or you just don't have it. When, in fact, the science suggests that we are all creative. Creativity is embedded deep in our essential programming code. We are creative all the time. And that means we can all get better at it, too.
Well, we may be all creative, but there are some who are better than others with what they create. I mean, I'm thinking about kids, for example, and what they paint and the kind of nostrums that are made it out in schools nowadays. That's wonderful, Johnny. That's wonderful, Sally, and everything. But some kids just have much more ability.
For sure. Creativity is like any other human talent. It's a bell curve, so it's not distributed equally. Some people have more of it than others. But the essential point is that it is universal. It is this universal facet of human nature. And I think the myth of the creative type suggests that it's not.
Well, you go deeper than that in this book. For example, when Steve Jobs died, we were talking about him as a creative genius. And maybe Steve Jobs was just, a connector or a restructurer, as he himself kind of intimated.
Yeah, Steve Jobs has this wonderful quote about creativity where he says, creativity is just connecting things. And I think when you look at Steve Jobs' own career, he was an incredible manager of the innovation process. He didn't invent a lot of these gadgets. He found ways to bring designers and engineers and scientists together. And he realized that, you know, creativity is just connecting things, and most of those connections are going to come from other people. So I think his real his creative genius, if he had one, was finding a way to make those connections happen, you know, whether it was the Pixar studios or the Apple offices. He found a way to bring people together to create, you know, special things.
Well, you've done this with your book, actually. I mean, which shows the importance of knowledge in creativity. And you kind of argue for the importance of knowledge. That is, if you take a lot of things and synthesize them and then get an original idea from doing all that synthesis, that's where a lot of this power of creativity is originating.
Yeah, you know, a new idea at its essence is a new connection between old ideas. So you need knowledge. You need stuff in your head to be able to connect in the first place. You don't actually invent out of thin air.
And the fact of the matter is that you also make a distinction, I think, almost implicitly, or maybe you don't. Let's get you on record on this. I found myself vacillating reading your book between, say, scientific creativity and artistic creativity. And we get back to the old Snow Leavis two cultures here.
Yeah. You know, one of the reasons I wanted to begin the book by looking at creativity from the perspective of the brain is the brain is a great category buster. It's great at taking these categories that we assume are so entrenched, whether it's, you know, art and science or whatnot, and showing that, you know what, it all comes from the same place inside your head. So I don't think we can draw a clear distinction between the type of creativity artists do and the type of creativity scientists do. They're all engaged in the same kind of problem solving. They're all trying to make something new. They're all trying to make sense of data, whether their data is, you know, bits of PCR, you know, bits on a PCR gel, or trying to make sense of, you know, brushstrokes on a canvas. It is about problem solving. It's about trying to come up with something new that strikes you as beautiful and true.
Jonah Lehrer is our guest in studio. He's the author of Imagine, How Creativity Works. He's also editor-at-large for Seed Magazine, and he'll be appearing later on today at 8 p.m. at City Arts and Lectures at the Herbst Theater as part of City Arts and Lectures, and tomorrow at 7 o'clock at the Ashman Family JCC Cultural Arts Center in Palo Alto. And there's something that comes across in terms of creativity that I wanted to get out here and get some comment from you on, because my mother was a great believer, as was Norman Vincent Peale, in the power of positive thinking. It turns out that positive thinking can help creativity.
It absolutely can. It turns out when you show people a 5-minute video of Robin Williams doing stand-up, so it's very, very funny stuff, and so then they're in a more positive mood, that they solve 20% more of these difficult creative problems called insight problems. So they become significantly more creative. And this is large part because when we're happy, when we're in a positive mood, we're also more relaxed. And there's a very, very clear body of research that states of relaxation are much better for generating moments of insight. So when you need to solve a very, very difficult problem, a seemingly impossible problem, what you need to do is to get happy and relaxed.
There are a lot of examples that you use, and we'll get into some of those, some fascinating examples. Just, some that come quickly to mind that I wanted to kind of catalog here is an ad agency guy who read Norman Mailer's book, The Executioner's Song, and heard about Gary Gilmore going to his death and saying, "Let's do it," and boom, that became Nike's. Or woman Ruth Handler, who many know, went and saw this big doll, which was maybe going to be used for other purposes, and thought Barbie doll. So you have those kind of examples throughout here. The guy that invented Post-it sitting in church. Let's talk about just the general neuroscience here. Something happens in those examples, in many of these legion number of examples that we can think of and that you bring to our attention, of the right in the right hemisphere of the brain. It's literally, figuratively, kind of like a light bulb going on about their head, like Archimedes.
Yeah. So these are known as moments of insight. When we have these epiphanies out of the blue, they come to us when we're shampooing our hair in the shower. And they seem very, very mysterious. You know, one of their defining features is that we have no idea where the idea came from. We can't explain why it happened or why it happened to us just then. So they're very, very mysterious. And yet scientists have found a way to study them in the lab. And they do this by giving people these various kinds of creative problems that are often solved in a moment of insight. One of my favorite examples comes from the research of Mark Beeman at Northwestern and John Kunios at Drexel. And they give people something called compound remote associate problems. The acronym is a bit unfortunate, CRAP. But they involve giving people three words, and they have to find the fourth word that can form a compound word with those three. So a classic example is pine, crab, and sauce. The fourth word is apple, pineapple, crab, apple, applesauce. And apple will often come to you just in a moment of insight, like a light bulb going off inside your head, as you put it. And so by giving people these problems inside an fMRI machine, inside a brain scanner, they can see what happens in the brain in the seconds before one of these insights appears. And what they find is a sharp spike in activity in a part of the brain called the anterior superior temporal gyrus, a obscure bit of brain in the back of the right hemisphere. Nobody knows too much about it, but it's been previously associated with things like the processing of jokes and the interpretation of metaphors.
Well, yeah, MRIs are opening up so many new vistas here, aren't they?
Yeah, it's
MRI technology. Yeah.
You know, it's an imperfect technology. You're not looking at brain activity directly. You're looking at changes in blood flow as a proxy. But it has allowed us to get glimmers of activity inside the black box, to really begin to understand what's happening inside our head. And especially when you can use fMRI in conjunction with other technologies that allow you to look at brain waves, for instance, that have better timing resolution, you can actually begin to learn some interesting stuff about how these 3 pounds of meat, you know, make sense of the world or generate moments of insight.
It's interesting the example you use of Bob Dylan, because a while back we did an hour with Grill Marcus, who wrote a whole book about that song, Like a Rolling Stone. Yeah. And notwithstanding the fact that you say living in an urban culture and living in the city enhances creativity, here was Dylan over in the countryside sort of deciding that he had pretty much given up songwriting.
Yeah. This is May 1965. He's just returned from a grueling tour. The last stop of the tour was in the UK. And while performing the last shows in London, Dylan tells his manager that he is quitting the music business. He is done with the singing and songwriting. He is sick of being a folk singer, sick of being the prophetic poet of his generation. He's sick of the expectations. He just wants to be left alone. And he wasn't bluffing. He arrives in New York City, drives his motorcycle straight up to Woodstock, doesn't even bring his guitar. He's going to become a painter, he says. After a couple days in this cabin in rural upstate New York, Dylan feels this familiar feeling, what he calls the itch of unwritten words. And so he does the only thing he knows how to do, which is he gets out a pencil and a pad of paper and he starts to scribble. The words just vomit out of him. This, you know, vomit is his
Describe
verb.
It like kind of a ghost or something.
Yeah, yeah. He says possessed. You're being visited by a ghost and all you want to do is get out of the way. So he's describing all, you know, the classic experience of a moment of insight. You have no idea why the idea is coming to you. You just need to get it out. And so he starts writing and writing, spends the next several hours just scribbling in his notebook. And within that scribble, within those 25 pages of notes, these words that just pour out of him are the lyrics to one of the most influential rock and roll songs of all time, Like a Rolling Stone. And it all came in this moment of insight. It came after he'd quit the music business. It came after he'd basically given up because he didn't think he had a new song in him.
And it came in a rural environment too.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah.
It came when he was relaxed. You know,
the point being the relaxation. Yeah. Understood. And yet at the same time, I couldn't help thinking, you point out also that traveling opened you up in ways to creativity. Maybe it was going to Woodstock that opened him up. Although I remember my Emerson. Emerson said, you know, you take you wherever you go.
So yeah.
There's always that to consider. We're talking again, if you just joined us, with Jonah Lehrer, and his new book is called Imagine How Creativity Works, and it brings us into all kinds of realms of creativity. Fascinating to read about Auden and Benzedrine. This isn't a suggestion that one should use Benzedrine any more than alcohol, which helps perhaps with creativity to a degree too. I mean, I have to constantly tell students, no, you don't have to be like Raymond Carver was with alcohol or Malcolm Lowry, you know, or you don't have to take drugs like William Burroughs to get creative. But alcohol does help, and Benzedrine helped Auden.
Yes, when it comes to moments of insight, a paper just came out last month to show when you get undergraduates very drunk, so too drunk to drive, that they solve 30% more of these difficult creative problems that require moments of insight. In part because they're a little happier, they're a little bit more relaxed, you know. So that's not a state of mind that you want to take a test in or you want to be driving in, for sure. But when you need to solve a difficult creative problem, you know, a couple beers, maybe take a beer and then take a hot shower, you know, that may help you. And the research suggests that anything you can do to put your mind at ease, to stop thinking about that problem, will make it easier to hear that quiet voice coming from the back of your head trying to give you the answer. So this is counterintuitive. I think most people assume the way to solve every creative problem is to focus, to chug caffeine and chain yourself to your desk. But that's often the exact wrong approach. You'll be focused, but you'll just be focused on the problem. It's not until you're relaxed that you're able to turn the spotlight of attention inwards and hear that quiet voice
that's
trying to give you the answer.
Take a little schnapps, maybe. You know,
exactly.
That sort of thing, right? But what about dreams? You know, the benzene ring came out of a dream. Robert Louis Stevenson's book, Jekyll and Hyde, came out of a dream. I mean, relaxation, unconscious, also solving perhaps creativity?
Absolutely. So another study that came out very, very recently looked at how grogginess can make us more creative. So you can take students and you ask them, are you a night person or a morning person? If they're a night person, you give them these creative problems first thing in the morning. If they're a morning person, you give them late at night. And what you discover is people actually solve a lot more problems when they're least awake and alert. So it's being kind of in a liminal space between wakefulness and sleep seems to be a very productive mental mode. And then, of course, there's deep sleep. Research suggests that actually sleeping on it is a great approach, that you can give people – you can give subjects a variety of difficult creative problems and you can divide them into groups. One group, they can't sleep at all. You keep them awake. The other group, you let them fall asleep, but you don't let them lapse into REM sleep. So they're never actually dreaming. It's got to be incredibly frustrating to be in that group. And the third group, you let them fall into a deep sleep.
So when people say, I want to sleep on that, that's literally true.
What you find is that the people who sleep on it, when they wake up, they solve anywhere between 30 to 50% more of the creative problems. That's because when you're sleeping, your mind is still hard at work. It's looking for those associations. It's trying to make sense of the world.
I kind of have you tell the story about Yo-Yo Ma and the impossible chord.
This is a story told to me by Bruce Adolph, a wonderful modern composer, who, when he was a student at Juilliard, he was writing his first piece for the cello. And he didn't know what he was doing, so he wrote this 10-minute little ditty, showed it to his teacher, and his teacher said, oh, this is a nice piece, but you know, there's an impossible chord here. You can't actually play this chord. His roommate at the time was Yo-Yo, and Yo-Yo just found this piece lying around his room and just started to play it, started to practice on it. And so one day, Bruce walks into his room and finds Yo-Yo playing his piece, and he watches as Yo-Yo plays through the entire piece, including the impossible chord. And at which point Bruce says, wait, wait, how you play that chord? And he watches as Yo-Yo somehow found a way to contort his hand on the fret of the instrument to play this chord that everyone else thought was impossible. It wasn't comfortable. And Yo-Yo would later say, yep, that's impossible. And yet he still found a way to make it possible.
He does, when he's playing, he does things with his body that are really quite revelatory too, doesn't he?
Yeah, and that's one of the things I wanted to, you know, that's one of the reasons I wanted to spend time with him in the book. And just get to watch him perform and try to figure out how he's so expressive. Because he is, when you watch him perform, I think one of the things that sets him apart from his, you know, virtuosity as a performer, his ability to play those impossible chords, is he expresses the emotions in the music. He makes you feel, and you can see this in his bodily movements. He sways, you know, his shoulders heave and swell. His face makes these very, very rich expressions. And I think that's all part of the fact that he is finding a way to let himself go, that even though he is playing these incredibly intricate pieces of music, he isn't obsessed with perfection. He's obsessed with expression, that he wants to embody the very emotions and feelings he wants you to feel in the audience. And one of my favorite stories in the book actually comes when I was trying to figure out how Yo-Yo stays so relaxed, how he stays in that mindset of being able to let himself go. And he tells this great story about before he walks out on stage, he often thinks about Julia Child, and in particular about Julia Child, you know, cooking, making a roast chicken on television, and it's a beautiful chicken, and then she drops the chicken on the floor. And he says, how does Julia Child react? Does she make this look of horror? Does she scream? No, she doesn't even, you know, she keeps on smiling, picks the chicken up, dusts it off a little bit, and then goes on as if nothing had happened. He said, to him, that's his ideal model of performance. You know, you have to be able to embrace that mistake because then you're free.
It's also certainly relevant to what you conclude about creativity, that you have to keep trial and error, mistake, failure, and so forth until you get to the place. What do we learn, though, from the impossible chord story?
I'm not sure we learned too much other than that Yo-Yo Ma is an incredibly gifted performer.
That we certainly knew. In fact, speaking about incredibly gifted, of course, I've often said it's become boilerplate for me that probably the most consummate literary genius of all time was Shakespeare. And you make the point that he does a lot of connecting. He does a lot of, I mean, some say plagiarism, but taking from different ideas and stories. And that's really what his whole body of work is based on.
Yeah, Shakespeare, if he were alive today, he'd violate a lot of copyright laws. But he was a consummate mixer. And I think Shakespeare really benefited from living in this age of what sociologists refer to an age of excess genius. That it is kind of awe-inspiring when you think about all the geniuses, the literary geniuses who lived in basically the same zip code in the same decade. So it wasn't just Shakespeare. Shakespeare and Christopher Marlowe and John Donne and Francis Bacon. You go down the list and these guys basically invented English literature, and yet they all lived in London in the 1580s and 1590s.
So the zeitgeist can help creativity too and does help.
Yeah. And you do see these ages of excess genius appearing throughout history, whether it's ancient Athens or Renaissance Florence or Elizabethan England. And I think there are patterns that begin to explain why these ages of excess genius keep on coming back.
Astrologers have answers too. We're talking to Jonah Lehrer, by the way, and he is editor-at-large for Seed Magazine, author of How We Decide. And Proust was a neuroscientist. And the new book, Imagine How Creativity Works. So this book was given quite laudatory remarks by among others, Malcolm Gladwell. Do you generally find yourself in agreement with Malcolm Gladwell that, in terms of his book Blink, that these kinds of things come to us very quickly and maybe we should trust them more than we do trying to focus, work out, ratiocination, all that?
I mean, I think the larger lesson of Blink is really a testament to the powers of the unconscious mind. You know, the supercomputer in our head is not the part we're actually in control of. Consciousness is just the tip of the iceberg to abuse that cliche. And that's absolutely true. That's, I think, one of the big themes of modern neuroscience, that most of the processing taking place inside our head takes place, you know, outside of conscious awareness. And in many instances, all this unconscious processing can be a tremendous source of wisdom. We know more than we know. And I think one of the things Blink tried to get across is that when you're an expert in something, when you've taken the time to accumulate experience and expertise, that expertise isn't embedded as a set of, you know, as a set of explicit facts inside your head. It's really embedded as a set of intuitions and feelings that allow you to act without even knowing why or how you're acting.
You make a case for the internet being a good potential for originality, and I wondered about that. I'd like to kind of, to forgive the cliche, go to your brain on this, so to speak. Ted Rozek, I don't know if you know who he was, wrote a book that was really a pioneering book called The Making of the Counterculture, but also wrote a large number of books through the years, and unfortunately passed away. But he talked about computers as being a threat to creativity, as being menacing to creativity, and being interfering and inhibiting with creativity. He really took a strong stance there. You don't see that? With children.
Yeah. You know, I see it in my own life in terms of the one drawback I'm aware of is the sense in which sometimes I wish I was able to daydream more. You know, we spend a lot of our lives in the midst of daydreams. We are a daydreaming species. We're always disappearing down the rabbit holes of our own mind. And I think one thing I've found for myself is that I daydream less because I've got this computer in my pocket that as soon as I get a little bit bored, I get out of my phone and I check my email and Twitter and all the rest. I'm always interrupting my daydreams. And I think that's a problem because there's a very clear scientific literature, the fact that daydreaming is good for us, that people who daydream more score much higher on tests of creativity, that when we're daydreaming, we're mashing together ideas, forming new associations, exploring counterfactuals. So it's an essential mental process. And I sometimes wonder if we've forgotten how to daydream productively, if now we're always so connected that we're always cutting our wandering mind off. And I do wonder if that's one of the reasons we have all these rich anecdotes about people having their epiphanies in the shower, because if there's one place you still can take your smartphone, it's the shower.
Sal Bellow, I think, in Herzog said that maybe they also come when you're doing your mortal things in the bathroom. I don't know if you find any credence in that, but there are all sorts of ways of
whatever people find relaxing is going to work for them.
I'm going to give out the phone number and invite those of you listening to join this conversation, fascinating conversation about creativity, where it comes from, what its sources are, stories about creativity, lots in this book. In fact, it's a feast, and also a great deal of understanding about how the neuroscience works in creativity. Feel free to join the program. It's toll-free, and you can join us from wherever or however you're listening to us. 866-733-6786 is the number to call, and we welcome your calls. That's 866-733-6786, or email us, email address forum@kqed.org, or you can post any questions or comments you have on our website by simply going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or go to our Facebook page. Many ways to communicate with us, and we do want to hear from you, and we want to have you join this conversation. A couple other things that we want to talk about quickly, though. Grit. Important.
Yeah. Very, very important. This is a new character trait, first identified by a psychologist named Angela Duckworth in 2005. And she did this in conjunction with West Point, because West Point wanted to find a way to identify those who were least likely to persist through the first 6 weeks of West Point, which are this very tough time where you shave your head and you go on long runs and you wake up early. It's called Beast Barracks. And so they wanted a way to, you know, see who is not going to make it through that. And they lose between 5% and 10% of their class during the first 6 weeks. And so she came in, administered the survey she called the Grit-O survey, which has questions in two different domains. One is, you know, are you single-minded about your goal? Have you always wanted to go to West Point, et cetera? And two, how willing are you to persist through failure and frustration to accomplish that goal? And what she found is that this is the first thing that actually predicts retention at West Point. She has since found that in all sorts of different domains, from Teach for America to National Spelling Bee, the levels of grit predict success. I'd argue it's particularly important in creative domains simply because, you know, to make something new, it's never going to be easy. If it were easy, it would already exist. So you're going to have to persist through endless frustration and failure, and that's why it takes grit.
We'll continue this conversation with Joan Allaire, who is the author, again, of Imagine How Creativity Works, and take your calls and hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with author and journalist Joan Allaire. His newest book is Imagine How Creativity Works. Former Rhodes Scholar, editor-at-large for Seed Magazine, also a contributing editor of Wire and frequent contributor to The New Yorker. And you read his Headcase column, those of you who read The Wall Street Journal. And Also frequently appears on Radiolab, which we have many followers of and devotees of who listen to this program. He'll be appearing tonight, 8 p.m. at City Arts and Lectures at the Herb Theater, actually, as part of the City Arts and Lectures. And tomorrow at 7 o'clock at the Ushman Family JCC Cultural Arts Center in Palo Alto. We'll go to your calls here in just a moment. I want to run a couple of things past Jonah, though, before we did, that come out of his book that I thought really ought to be part of the mix here. And one of them is what you call being stumped and frustration. It helps, again, in just in terms of neuroscience, because it shifts from the left to the right hemisphere and find you can be more creative as a result.
Well, I think what that feeling of frustration, the act of being stumped, really does, it forces you to search for remote associations. It forces you to escape the familiar, to stop thinking in literal prose and think more in symbolist poetry. And this, I think, makes sense in the context of you look at people in the creative business. They are always giving themselves constraints, because what those constraints do is they make them stumped. They basically force them to be stumped. And you can see this probably best among poets. You know, there's a reason that so many poets rely on very strict poetic forms. They force themselves to write in sonnets and haykus, to count syllables and come up with elaborate
villanelles. I've been teaching some of those recently.
You know, very, very elaborate rhyming schemes. And at first glance, this makes no sense. You know, writing poetry is hard enough. Why would you make it even harder by giving yourself these elaborate forms?
Constriction of the form, isn't
well,
it?
Exactly. Yeah. So those constraints actually unleash us. When you start searching for just a word that rhymes with this other word, you end up with a much more original set of associations, a much more original set of adjectives and metaphors. Then, in a sense, we break out of the box by stepping into shackles. And so that's why the feeling of being stumped by giving ourselves these very strict constraints actually unleashes the imagination in many instances.
Judy just sent me a message. Have you talked about brainstorming yet? Well, we haven't, but there's a study I wanted to bring up with you from Northwestern, actually a Northwestern sociologist on Broadway shows and collaborations that went into Broadway shows that you reference in your book. It turns out that brainstorming, I guess, can be done best. It's sort of like the Goldilocks story. If there's not too much or too little in terms of the relationships,
So this study by Brian Newsy, which he did alongside Jared Spiro, they spent several years basically constructing a vast social network of everyone who worked on Broadway, made Broadway musicals over the course of the 20th century. And the reason is they wanted to study the ideal way to assemble a creative team. And, you know, by definition, a musical is a perfect example of artistic collaboration, because you can't create a musical by yourself. Instead, it's a set of diverse artists coming together. It's choreographers and lyricists and librettists and directors taking notes from producers and so on. Uzi and Spiro initially assumed that the best teams would be the ones who had worked together before. So they were all old friends. They were repeat relationships. In fact, Broadway producers often seek out such repeat relationships because they seem more reliable. But that's not what Uzi and Spiro found. They found the teams that knew each other too well, they tended to fail at the box office, and critics also didn't like it. And the critics would often use the language of, it's more the same old, this feels too familiar to us. So then Uzi and Spiro looked at teams where everyone was complete strangers, where no one knew each other well at all. They hadn't worked together before. And what they found is that these plays, these musicals also tended to fail at the box office. Instead, they found there was this very small sweet spot of the best teams. And they assigned all these teams a metric called Q, is a scale from 1 to 5. And the sweet spot was between 2.2 and 2.7. And their favorite case study is West Side Story, which is you have three people who knew each other very well, Jerome Robbins, Leonard Bernstein, Arthur Lorentz. But they realized they needed a fresh voice. They wanted a lyricist who hadn't worked on Broadway before, someone they didn't know at all. They found this 25-year-old with absolutely no experience, and his name was Stephen Sondheim. And so, you know, what Uzi argues is it was that introduction of Stephen Sondheim that brought West Side Story into the sweet spot of team collaboration. So when in doubt, when you're assembling a team, don't just go for those people who feel most comfortable.
Just find someone who's a genius like Sondheim.
It helps if you actually invite Stephen Sondheim into your room, of course. But you know, the larger lesson is it also helps to just have that fresh voice. It helps to have a little tension in the room, that too much comfort can backfire. Because, you know, I think intuitively we seek out people who are just like us, what psychologists call the self-similarity principle. But when assembling a creative team, you also want new voices. You want fresh people who you don't actually know, because they're the ones who will get you somewhere interesting. They're the ones who will actually spark an interesting conversation.
John Alaris here, having certainly sparked an interesting conversation with him. His new book is Imagine, How Creativity Works. Malcolm Gladwell, I mentioned before, says some good things about the book. John Alaris' new book confirms what his fans have known all along. He knows more about science than a lot of scientists and more about writing than a lot of writers. Well, you're 30 now, right?
Yeah.
As Fitzgerald would say, you're too old to lie to yourself anymore. But, I mean, all this success at the age of 30, a little heady, isn't it, in some ways?
Gosh, you know, I just try to put words on a page. It's very gratifying, to have people who are interested in the book. But you know, I think one of the joys for me being a science writer is it's an inherently humbling profession, simply because I think if you're doing it right, you know that you're really in a very parasitic relationship to the scientific enterprise. That these facts aren't my facts. I'm describing the work of Brian Uzzi. I'm describing the research of Mark Beeman. Someone else has to give me the facts to hopefully translate accurately. So you know, it is, I think, if you're doing it right, it's very hard to get too carried away, simply because, you know that someone else is doing the work. Someone else is spending years and years searching through the dusty playbills in Broadway basements, trying to find the social network that they can then turn into a very elegant study that I can hopefully write about. But that's one of the things I enjoy about being a science writer.
Well, let's talk just for a moment about the great science writers. I mean, for my money, so to speak, they're writers who are creative and who have a lot of humanistic understanding as well as understanding science. Lauren Isley comes to mind, mm-hmm. and Tim Ferriss comes to mind.
Yeah. And I think both of those writers, and they're two of my favorites too, alongside people like Oliver Sacks, what they're interested in and what they do so well is not just talk about the abstract experiments in the lab, as important as those can be, but also find ways to connect those to the real world to help explain why this empiricism, why these facts matter to us. And that's, you know, that's often a hard thing to do. That's when I'm writing these books, what occupies a lot of my time is trying to figure out, how I can make the research come alive, what stories I can tell alongside it so that people understand this isn't just about giving undergrads a set of funny puzzles and a brain scanner. It actually relates to the real world. It explains something interesting about their own experience.
You know Lewis Thomas's book, Lies
yeah.
of a Cell? Also about as good as it gets, I think.
Absolutely.
Let me bring some callers in, and we go to Roner Park first. Tony, hi, you're on.
Hi. First-time caller, love your show. And I'm a high school art teacher, and I am constantly pushing the idea of critical thinking through my art and through, like, the projects I give my students. But I find that your statistic in the beginning of the program, about 5% of high school seniors thinking they are creative and the rest not, I run into that all the time. I run into students saying, I'm just not a creative person. I don't, I don't know what to do with this more than anything. And I find that it's incredibly difficult for me to convince somebody who's convinced themselves that they're not creative, but also that society has convinced them that they're not creative. And I see a lot of factors throughout, some of it is the what they go to on the internet as opposed to the internet itself, and some of it is what they see, and also the educational system of regurgitating answers as opposed to creating your own answers. And it's incredibly frustrating, but I'm also sometimes at a loss. And I don't know, is there anything about, like, how to change society's aspect of creativity itself? I mean, obviously you've written a book, but...
Well, it is one of the reasons I wanted to write the book is because it killed me when you talk to, high school students and they'd say, oh, I'm just not creative. And they'd look at, the person who was wearing the funny clothes and say, that's a creative type. And that is just such a dangerous misconception. And I think, the first thing we have to do from the perspective of education is really focus on this crucial transition period in third, fourth, fifth grade, what educators often refer to as the fourth grade slump, which is where kids all of a sudden stop wanting to draw, paint, write short stories, in large part because they become aware that you can draw a line in the wrong place. You can put the brush, make a bad brush stroke. They start to realize that their short stories don't always live up to their expectations. So I think the first thing we have to do is to really make kids aware that, your drawing may not look like you want it to look right now, but if you invest the effort, if you put in those 10,000 hours of deliberate practice, it can get much better. You can develop your talent. But I think, sadly, the first step is not to focus directly on high school kids, it's to focus earlier on in the educational process.
Chris, you can learn early on that you just don't draw that well. I mean, In my case, for example, you know, I learned pretty early on in my education.
For sure.
And it's creative in other ways, maybe, but not drawing.
And that's why I think it's so important to expose kids to a menu of possibility, you know, so they can find something they truly love. Angela Duckworth, the psychologist who's pioneered the study of grit, she's got this great maxim for how to build grit up, which is choose easy, work hard. That when you're trying to figure out what goal you should strive for in the first place, choose one that doesn't feel like work. Choose one that feels easy, that you just fall in love with. But then know that after you make that commitment, you're going to have to put in lots and lots of work. You're going to have to persist through failure and frustration. But this gets back to the importance of arts education in the sense that we have to expose kids to a real wide menu of possibilities so they can find something to fall in love with in the first place.
Let's go to another caller. Lisa, join us. You're on Forum. Hi.
Hi. I find this discussion completely fascinating, and I had two experiences that really speak to what you're talking about. I lived in Spain for 3 years, so I was forced into a whole nother culture with a whole nother language. And what I would find is, and still to this day, if I just drink a little bit of alcohol, just one glass of wine, I would be able to speak my Spanish much more coherently, and it would just flow, and I would end up having full dinner parties with my husband's colleagues and really be able to just enter into these deep conversations. But if I was sitting with my Spanish professor with a cup of coffee, I would be fumbling all over the place. So I definitely agree that a little bit of alcohol just completely uninhibits the other pieces of your brain that are really trying to work on a skill that you don't have completely under control. The other comment is, while in Spain as well, complicated appliances and things, but we couldn't always understand how to use them, and we had this dumbwaiter in our home that jammed one time. My husband got it unjammed, but we couldn't figure out what to do to get it working again. And that night, I dreamed of a little red button that went to an on-off switch, and indeed I went to the garage, searched for a button, and there was this red button. I turned it on and the elevator worked again. So amazing. I don't know how that even happened, but I must have picked up some information about it somewhere along the line, but it needed that dream state to figure out how to fix it.
Well, thank you for that. And the red button story reminds me of the story that Jonah tells in his book about the guy who came up with the heart for I Love New York, which has become sort of, well, ubiquitous, really, in so many things.
And I thought the first story is really fascinating, too, about the sip of wine and then you can speak Spanish fluently, because that reminds me of some really interesting work on jazz pianists who engage in improv, you know, who can step out on stage and just pour beauty out of their instruments for hours at a time. And that's long been a creative mystery, because how does one do that? It's such an awe-inspiring talent. And what scientists have found by putting jazz pianists in brain scanners is that before they engage in improv, they actually inhibit their inhibitions. They deactivate a part of the brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. It's just behind your forehead. It's closely involved with impulse control, so it keeps us from saying stupid stuff. It, you know, keeps us from eating too much ice cream, but it also holds us back. It keeps us from speaking fluent Spanish when we actually know it better than we think we know it. It's kind of the sensor inside our head. And what these jazz musicians are able to do because of their years of practice is they can, in a sense, turn it off on command. And then once they do that, they're able to create without worrying about what they're creating. So the scientists will often compare the act of improv to the act of learning a second language, that you have to put in so much work. You have to practice all your verb conjugations and learn this whole new vocabulary. But the point of all that work is to one day make it effortless. And then once it becomes effortless, once you've actually learned that language, then your real job is to get out of the way, to not hold yourself back.
Here's a listener who writes, over 40 years of working in Silicon Valley, I have much more often been rejected from jobs because I was, quote, too creative. The employers always say they don't want creative people because they get bored and quit. I show employers beautiful artistic portfolios and then get a mountain of flowcharts to do. And there are never enough people who write HTML and JavaScript. Creativity has become a euphemism for whatever the company needs done. It's interesting, especially in light of what you point out about places like Google and 3M, that there's emphasis on breaks, on, again, relaxing.
Yeah, and this speaks to the difficulty of, I think, managing creative individuals and managing the innovation process. It is a very tough thing to manage, in large part because it's not linear. It's not a straight line. And some of the most productive things we can do are going to look to our bosses like we are wasting time. You know, it's the great Einstein line, creativity is the residue of time wasted. So if you're a boss, you can look at an employee who's taking a nap on the couch, and it may look like he's being lazy when maybe he's just stumped. Maybe he needs a moment of insight, in which case taking a nap, going for a walk, playing ping pong is the most productive thing he can do.
You mentioned Einstein. A listener writes on our website, I think Einstein had a handle on the roots of creativity when he wrote, quote, creativity doesn't come from doing what you're supposed to diligently do. That's discipline. No, creativity comes from trying things we're not supposed to, from not using those ticking seconds efficiently, from avoiding work, from adding fun to a boring task, and from the mind that says to itself, wouldn't it be funny if? I mean, we're talking, I think, about something that's really quite real here. That is the source of creativity. It doesn't necessarily, as you say, come from willing it or something volitional or that hard effort that goes into saying, I'm going to be creative.
No, no. It's you know, it is both, I think. It's about those moments of insight that come when you least expect it, that come when you're taking a nap, come when you're doing stuff that involves rule breaking and doing stuff that your boss thinks is just wasting time. But even after you have those moments of insight, you still need to put in the work. You still need to go through edit after edit. You still need to refine that idea until it's perfect. So I think the reality of creativity is that it involves both parts. It involves the rule breaking, involves, you know, those aha moments, those epiphanies, but it also just involves good old fashioned grit, persistence, stubbornness, you know, the so-called unconcealing process where you take that rough idea and you make it fit for the real world.
I have a listener, Kara, who says, any studies on creativity difference between genders?
Not a whole lot. And that's a theme you see again and again in scientific literature, that I think we have these intuitions that there are these big gender differences. But when you look at the scientific literature, at least in terms of creative performance, it's not something that pops out at you.
I want you to read this web comment.
It is the comment. This is pretty wonderful. I am 6 years old and love to draw and daydream at the same time. I can only hope he doesn't stop.
And the nice, or she.
Or she, or
the,
she.
Gender. And the nice that we're getting these younger demographics here at 6 years old. I love that. Karen joins us. Hi, Karen. You're on.
Hi. Yes. I was just wanting to know if you can speak a little more to the relationship of flow. Again, that's sort of reviving in the neuroscience world a lot. You mentioned jazz musicians before, but the whole pro-social, relational, embodied nature of what it seems anyway in a flow, how that helps, enhances, creates creativity, or at least enhances it.
So I think flow, this is a state first identified by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi.
You get points for pronouncing it.
Yes,
right.
And that's why I pronounced it, because I was so proud that I might be able to pronounce it correctly. But it tends to happen when we are fully immersed in activity, whether it's playing the jazz piano or drawing. It often involves some act of creative performance when we're just in the midst of a creative activity. And it turns out that people are just about at their happiest when they're in a flow state, that we are happier doing a flow state than we are when we're playing with our kids or watching TV or even on vacation, that there is something so wonderful about being dissolved in an activity. So I think, you know, I see flow states as not, you know, not necessarily when we come up with our best ideas, but as almost the dessert of creativity. They are the reward for putting in those thousands of hours of practice. If you put in that practice, eventually you will be able to reach the state where you can just do it and be immersed in it and not worry about mistakes or errors. You're just fully absorbed in the task. And that really is when we're happiest. So this is almost why people create in the first place, to get the reward of a flow state.
Let me thank the caller and go to another web comment. Actually, a question from a listener says, I don't know if this question arises because I'm a law student or because I just got out of my constitutional law class, which is always focusing on defining and distinguishing terms. But in this discussion of how creativity works, a number of studies or stories have been mentioned that focus on how to solve a creative problem. However, I don't feel like I truly understand what Mr. Lehrer exactly means by creativity or a creative problem. Could anything be considered a creative problem, or do you have to have a specific set of parameters in mind when discussing creativity and creative problems?
You know, this is something when I was beginning the book, I worried a lot about how exactly to define creativity, how to define innovation. And after much fretting, I realized it's so hard to define. We could spend the rest of the day trying to define new and useful, trying to define our parameters, trying to figure out exactly where a creative problem just becomes an ordinary problem, an analytical problem. I think in the end, creativity is something you just know it when you see it. So I don't fret too much about the exact boundaries between creative problems and normal problems. I think in the end, when people demonstrate creativity, it's when they come up with something new, something that didn't exist before, and that helps them solve a problem. And there are so many problems out there that I don't worry too much about the exact parameters.
Another listener writes on the web site, and you can, by the way, put your comments there, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on the segment. I always cringe when I hear about corporations trying to instill innovation in their companies. They always manage to engineer the creativity out of people and groups. What are your guest thoughts on the business of creativity?
There's a lot of truth in that comment. And this comes from a great data analysis by Jeffrey West, a theoretical physicist at the Santa Fe Institute. He's probably best known for his work on cities. He collects these vast tracts of data from the Patent Office and Census Bureau and governments all across the world. And what he finds is that as cities get bigger, everyone in that city becomes more creative and productive. So as cities get bigger, you invent more patents per capita, more trademarks per capita, people make more money. And that's why cities are so valuable. That's driving the process of urbanization, because when we're around other smart people, we get smarter. Being surrounded in these density of ideas, we have more new ideas. But then he compares cities to companies. And his first point is that cities and companies look very similar, right, from a certain perspective, that they're both big clusters of people in a fixed physical space. But cities and companies exhibit this one very interesting difference, which is that cities never die, whereas companies die all the time. The average lifespan of a Fortune 500 company is about 40 years. 25% of Fortune 500 companies die every decade. So West's question is, what's the difference? Why do cities live forever, and why are companies so fragile and ephemeral? And what he's found is that, you know, as I said, cities get bigger, people in them become more innovative and productive. As companies get bigger, everyone in them becomes less innovative and productive. So as companies get bigger, and Wall Street's always saying, get bigger, grow the bottom line, you see fewer patents per capita, fewer trademarks per capita, less profit per employee. So cities are superlinear, companies are sublinear. And over time, this drop-off in innovation as companies get bigger makes them very vulnerable, right? Because you've got, you know, a lot of fixed costs, this expensive bureaucracy to maintain, but you're no longer generating new ideas at the same rapid pace. So you become more reliant on your old ideas, and then one day those old ideas no longer work, and then you go belly up. Now, West argues the reason companies exhibit this very distinct property from cities, you know, the reason they get less innovative as they get bigger, is because companies get in the way. Companies tell us to brainstorm. Brainstorming doesn't work. They invent these elaborate hierarchies. They silo knowledge. They tell us which problems to work on. They tell us, you know, don't daydream, don't take naps, don't play ping pong. They try to force and micromanage creativity. And that's a very dangerous thing. So West's advice is simple. When in doubt, if you're a company, imitate the city.
Next caller. Is your name Brain or Brian?
Brian.
Brian, okay. I thought it would be interesting to hear from somebody named Brain. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I really appreciated this conversation and glad I get a chance to chime in. I just want to share one quick experience and then a research article. But personal experiences, when I've composed music, there's been times where I've had stumbling blocks for sometimes weeks on a piece. And I remember one piece in particular that I think is applicable to this conversation is, it was a flamenco piece. I was trying to learn the Bulerias rhythm, and it's a hard 12-beat rhythm. And so a little bit odd, but, you know, we are artists. I slept with my metronome at a low volume underneath my pillow for about 3 or 4 nights. And finally one night I woke up and I had the piece. I had this section that I could not quite figure out. And I wrote it out and went to my flamenco teacher in Fresno. And I had finally gotten what was trying to come out that I just was tripping over for several weeks. And so that was one powerful experience that I had.
Which tells us that maybe it's a good idea to sleep with your metronome. And thank you for that call. Here's a listener in Mountain View, Anne, who writes, all children are creative beings, but as an elementary school parent, I have observed how some children tend to naturally prefer to play in an imaginative way, and others tend to prefer more literal games. The imaginative kids seem to be comfortable playing the literal games as long as they have other creative outlets, but the same does not seem to hold true for the kids who prefer literal play, at least without the direction from a teacher or parent. I've witnessed this since preschool, and I've also observed how creativity in the classroom is often treated like something to be trotted out occasionally in a controlled way, or at best tolerated, rather than nurtured as an integral part of the child and the curriculum, or how teachers who do nurture creativity are almost looked askance at as not being serious enough. I've also witnessed how children who prefer imaginative play become very unhappy and demoralized when they have no creative outlet, and how they can even become ostracized if creativity is not respected and fostered. I don't know if the converse would be true for kids who prefer literal play, because I've just never witnessed it, or perhaps where I didn't recognize it because the dynamic was positive. Seems to me that fostering creativity in adults is all about nurturing creativity in all very young children and respecting it throughout the educational process. Would love to know what Mr. Lehrer's opinions are of these observations. First of all, what about that dichotomy between literal play and imaginative play?
I'm not aware of that dichotomy in the scientific literature, but I think the comment raises some very interesting questions about how we can do a better job of encouraging creativity, especially among young kids in the classroom, because it is something that's very difficult to do. Obviously, one doesn't want 30 little Pablo Picassos running around the classroom. That'd be very difficult to manage. But I do think we have to do a better job of realizing that creativity requires various ways of thinking. And right now, our classrooms are built around the assumption that the only way to be productive is to focus, focus, focus. That's why we diagnose up to 20% of our kids with attention deficit disorders. We assume that when you need to solve a problem, when you need to be productive, you need to invest more attention in it. So one of the first lessons we teach our kids is don't daydream. Don't stare at the window. Focus. Stare at the blackboard instead. When in fact, as we talked about earlier, daydreaming turns out to be a remarkably productive mental mode. So I think we have to do a better job of realizing
that.
Doesn't
help you on the exams you have to take though.
No, not necessarily, but it will help you come up with new ideas, you know, in the real world.
I was thinking about the image in the classroom of the kid daydreaming. I mean, teachers do discourage that for a specific reason. They have to provide learning to the child. You know?
Exactly, and that's why I think this is a tough issue to navigate. I think one can't just, you know, encourage unbridled daydreaming. We have to teach kids that, you know, part of creativity too is also learning how to focus, learning how to persist through those revisions and edits. That's an important part too, but we shouldn't go so far, which is I think where we're now, which is where we absolutely discourage kids from daydreaming. We discourage them from engaging in these mental modes, which we know are closely associated with some of our best ideas. And I think we also just have to take a more expansive notion of what good thinking looks like. So studies have shown, for instance, that people with ADD, attention deficit disorders, that in the real world, if they're high functioning, that they're actually much more likely to become eminent creative achievers. That being distractible can actually be a creative asset because you're always combining ideas in new ways. So some of the things which we assume are just burdens can actually turn out to be creative blessings.
On that fine note, we will conclude. Jonah Lehrer, good to have you back here on Forum. His new book, Imagine, How Creativity Works. And he'll be appearing tonight at 8 p.m. at Herb Theater for City Arts and Lectures, and tomorrow at the Ashman Family JCC Cultural Arts Center in Palo Alto. Again, many thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. And thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Judy Campbell and Tina Lauberg. Our engineer is Jim Bennett, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.